You're with SBS Radio. Find more great stories in your language at sbs.com.au.
You're listening to NITV Radio with me, your host today. I'm Kerry Lee Harding, and it's that time of the week again to yarn all things science and technology with our guest today, Ray Johnston, Editor of Science and Technology at NITV. Good afternoon to you, Ray.
Good afternoon, sis. How are you?
I'm well. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty well. I'm excited to talk some science with you today.
Deadly. Let's get amongst it, sis. I understand our medications are affecting our fishy friends in the waterways, sis. What can you tell us about this?
Yeah, it turns out that our antidepressants, they're contaminating the water and it's affecting the fish. This is a new study from Aussie researchers. They spent 2 years exposing generations of guppies to the antidepressant Prozac in levels that they described as realistic or similar to what they would be exposed to in the real world. And they found that even at low concentrations, the antidepressant pollution, which is a thing I didn't even know existed, it made the fish behave the same as each other, rather than having little differences in, you know, their speed and their mannerisms and their eating habits and where they'd go to explore things. They just kind of stuck together and behaved the same.
Mm.
And this is important to know about because the variety of behaviour in the animal kingdom, it's what helps populations become more resistant to change. And obviously our world is changing a lot at the moment. So unfortunately, our medications in the water are reducing the ability of fish populations to survive into the future in a changing world. And it's one of those difficult things because there's not really a whole lot that we can do about it because we need these medications. You know, maybe we just need to look at where our wastewater is headed and maybe work out some sort of awesome filtration process to make sure that our antidepressants aren't getting to our fish. It's the kind of thing that you just don't think about on a daily basis, but of course it makes perfect sense. You know, and this was just one study talking about, you know, antidepressants. You know, we've yet to see the studies coming out from different types of medications as well. So, you know, keeping those waterways as clean as we can is definitely something we need to be focusing on.
I think so for the future. Now we go from talking about our fishy friends to the weather. And I understand La Nina has peaked, sis. What can you tell us more about this issue?
Yeah, so La Nina is the massive cooling of the ocean surface temperatures, mainly around the central and eastern Pacific Ocean near the equator. And it also brings changes in the tropics, like winds and pressure and rainfall. It usually has the opposite impacts on weather and climate as El Nino, which is the warm phase that we're all very familiar with in a drought-ridden country. And they happen in a cycle of up to 4 years and then swap over. So we're in La Nina at the moment, and these two cycles, they're major drivers of the Earth's climate system. But all naturally occurring climate events like these, they now take place in a world where we've got human-induced climate change that exists. And that's increasing global temperatures, making extreme weather more extreme and impacting on seasonal rainfall patterns and making disaster prevention and management pretty chaotic. And La Nina does have that temporary global cooling effect, but it has peaked now, and it's not enough to prevent 2020 from being one of the three warmest years on record. So La Nina and El Nino effects on average global temperature, they're usually the strongest in their second year. So there's still a chance for 2021, but despite all the cooling influence of La Nina, land temperatures are still expected to be above normal for most parts of the globe from February to April in 2021. And in Australia, we have seen a pretty typical La Nina response. We've seen a lot more rainfall than normal over the last few months, and this is a trend that we're likely to see continue.
Now, I understand that rural and regional women, they actually need more support to breastfeed their babies, sis. Tell me more about this story.
Yeah, this was a major study that came out of La Trobe University And breastfeeding rates in regional communities, they're increasing, but it did reveal that there is need for greater support for some women to start breastfeeding. So it looked at 7,500 women who birthed at a large regional Victorian hospital between 2010 and 2017. And they worked out by talking to these women that there's a few risk factors in new mothers that contribute to lower rates of breastfeeding, including a high body mass index, teenage motherhood is a contributing factor, as well as smoking and being from a disadvantaged background. And obviously all women can benefit from having, you know, caring, targeted breastfeeding support after giving birth, but those falling into these risk categories have the most to gain. So whether or not a woman wants to start breastfeeding or not can be based on a range of factors, both, you know, physical and social. It can be from anything from how she feels about her body to, you know, what her friends are doing. And if health professionals like GPs and midwives and obstetricians are aware of these risk factors, they can start early to develop those strong, trusting relationships with women during pregnancy and help promote the benefits of giving breastfeeding a go, and just let them know that they're supported to do that in a really loving, nurturing kind of way, rather than, you know, just being told off for not doing it when it comes time. And yeah, this is obviously going to have huge long-term benefits for both the mothers and the babies. You know, we know that breastfeeding during the first month of life, you know, if you are fortunate enough to be able to do it, there's so many physical and mental health benefits for both the mother and the baby. And yeah, the bonding is such a lovely experience. So the more mums we can get breastfeeding, the better.
Sounds like we do need to get them more support to breastfeed across all different sectors of our community, in particular, as you just mentioned there, rural and regional women, Ray. Now we go from talking about women needing support to we're turning now to social media, to tweets that can reveal symptoms of depression. How does this work, sis?
Yeah, so this was a really interesting study out of the US that looked at a whole bunch of tweets, and they looked at them in terms of whether or not they were displaying what's known as distorted thinking, which is often linked to depression. So these are things like, you know, making things seem more catastrophic than they are, you know, black and white thinking without any grey areas, you know, mind reading, not real mind reading, but thinking that you know what the people around you are thinking about you. And they found that people with self-reported diagnosis of depression, they showed higher levels of certain kinds of distorted thinking on their Twitter. So examples like things like, you know, my grades are good, but it still feels like I will fail. Or, you know, I'm surrounded by people who say they love me, but secretly I know that they don't. And they found that these kind of tweets were more common with people with depression than people that, you know, don't have depression. And what we can learn from this is that there might be a way to engage with and intervene with mental health issues through social media by maybe setting up some kind of automated chatbot that recognizes these kinds of tweets.
Yeah.
And then goes, hey, you know, notice that your thinking, you know, isn't really quite right. You know, maybe we can get you some help with that. And I think that this is a really good idea, but we also need to be really careful using this kind of technology, you know, for privacy and ethical reasons. But if we can work out the kinks, imagine being able to help people in this way and reach out to them and let them know that they're not alone.
Because social media, of course, can cause many people to be depressed in some circumstances, sis. So this can be a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it can be a place where people go to get support, or it can be a place that causes people to feel upset in the first place. So I think, you know, really, the social media platforms do have a responsibility to be looking after the well-being of the people that are using those platforms with the way that they're set up. So, you know, maybe I can tap Twitter on the shoulder and go, hey, have you seen this study? Let's explore it.
I love that, sis. Now we go from talking about social media to Antarctic explorers. They've found animals attached to some boulders on the seafloor under an ice shelf for the very first time ever, which is very exciting.
This is so exciting. So you've got far underneath the ice shelves of the Antarctic. It turns out there's way more life than expected. So during an exploratory survey, researchers, they drilled through 900 meters of ice. This was 260 kilometers away from the open ocean where their research ship is. Now, current theories on what life could survive under the ice shelves, you know, it suggests that all life becomes less abundant as you move further away from open water and from sunlight. And past studies have found that, you know, some small mobile scavengers and predators like, you know, fish and worms or jellyfish or krill, you know, they've found some in these kinds of habitats. But like filter feeding organisms, like animals that depend on a supply of food from above, they were expected to be among the first to disappear under the ice. So it came as a huge surprise when this team of geologists drilling through the ice to collect sediment samples, they hit rock instead of mud at the bottom of the ocean below. And then they were even more surprised by video footage that came back from down there that showed this big boulder covered in strange creatures. Now, this is in darkness with temperatures of minus 2.2 degrees. Very few animals have been found in these conditions, but they've found a bunch of animals like sponges and maybe even new species attached to that boulder on the seafloor. And one of the amazing things about this is that it's raised so many more questions than answers. Like, how did they get there? You know, what are they eating? How long have they been there? How common are these boulders covered in life? You know, are these the same species that we see outside the ice shelf, or are they new species? You know, and floating ice shelves, they are the greatest unexplored habitat in the Southern Ocean. They cover an area of more than 1.5 million square kilometres of the Antarctic continental shelf. But get this, only a total area of about the size of a tennis court has been studied. So to answer these questions, we're going to have to find a way of getting up close with these animals and in their environment. So scientists have a lot of work ahead of them, but they've got reason to explore more now. I love this story. I'm so excited by it.
I love that story too. And that brings us to an end for our science and technology segment for this week. Thank you for your time today, Ray Johnston, editor of Science and Technology at NITV.
Thanks for having me, sis.
Want to hear more stories like this? Listen on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.